And if they keep getting a no merit decision, then is that when they go to court? Can they go to court at any point in this process when they're not satisfied with the process?
Yeah, see, you're fine. I hadn't noticed that. If it's no merit, no merit, no merit, can they still go to court?
You still could.
Because in order to get to the hearing examiner, there has to be a strong opinion that there's merit. I see that. I'd have to look in the AMA thing again to see if...
I would wonder if it's a constitutional issue and everyone has a right to bring it in court. And so if they can bail out at any point in the system, I'm not sure that the building will be moved at all.
You know, come to think of it, and I did this in 89, I'm not sure that the AMA plan even had an appeal to court. That may be my addition to try to make it constitutional here. I'll have to look at that again, but I see the flaw that you pointed out.
I guess
AMA, I think, was creating a closed system, that this was the way you had to do it.
A little bit more in why no one has used what we have, and is it? And you say it's because why not?
Why they haven't used arbitration?
Yeah, because it's not mandatory. Because it's
the provider doesn't trust the arbitrator, and the claimant doesn't either. I don't know. Is arbitration a big thing in Alaska anyway? Or, except in wage disputes.
Yeah,
I don't think it's
submarine is. It certainly is.
It's a legitimate way to set up labor.
Oh, another problem is that doctors are very reluctant to talk about bad outcomes in advance with a patient. You know, an informed consent, you have to paint the black picture, but when it's a Dr. Wilson, I'm a new patient. I've come to you. I'm in good health. I want you to examine me and so forth. And it's very difficult for me and most other doctors to point that out. I'm so glad you're here. By the way, let's sign an arbitration agreement. That if we have a disagreement down the line, we'll agree to go to arbitration.
You have to do that?
Well, that's what, yeah. It has to be in advance of illness, because at that point, the person is under duress and you can't sign it. Arbitration agreement once you're sick. It has to be in advance of an event that you agree, in case there's an event, this is the way you're going to settle the dispute. And doctors are just, it's very foreign to them to.
That's
to
how our
psychological impact, the psychological impact of doing that is a very negative one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
The patient will really think, my gosh, this guy must have really screwed up. You know, thanks, I'll believe him.
And once you're sick, it's too late to
do it. Our structure requires you to sign an agreement in advance. Our state structure requires it.
I think some doctors, not in Alaska, I don't know, but across the country, they do have these arbitration agreements that they hand out to patients. And
well,
sure, the doctor doesn't do it. The clerk doesn't say, here, sign this if you want to, and the doctor will sign it. I'm sure the doctor doesn't talk about it.
I've got a comment in my community. We have several doctors that are going bearish and indicated no insurance at all. But they do have their patients sign an agreement not to sue.
Do they?
And which really isn't valid, but it sort of has an impact, and they're just kind of going along. One of the things that kind of disturbs me is what Dave brought out. I guess the only reason we're even in this tort reform thing is we're looking for some way to reduce some of the factors out there driving this healthcare cost. If we're successful in arriving at some kind of a program that kind of reduces that cost, I guess what I was looking for is that carries on through to the charges that a person would experience in a doctor's office. And we're not going to be able to achieve that. I think we're really in a kind of a problem here. And also with Senator Collins' comments, that for the amount of money that's involved in this whole thing in litigation and malpractice, that there is gross unfairness, that very low amounts of those monies ever reach the damaged party. There's a publication that's put out by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I mentioned that before, but this issue is just not something that we're talking about here. It's going all over the country, and some of the numbers they've indicated are in the neighborhood that some 60% of the amount of money involved in this malpractice stuff doesn't end up going to the damaged party. It ends up going kind of an absorption factor within the system.
That's a rather high figure, and you can say a lot of good things about our tort system and jury system to bring out the ultimate truth, but even though it's good, I don't think that's an excuse for preserving a system that is less efficient than the gasoline auto engine, 30% or 40%. So it's no excuse for inefficiency, the fact that it has some good features to it.
Another comment on the funding, which you mentioned, this is all being paid for by all the folks that pay for health care, which is one of the factors in overhead that they're carrying. The insurance industry, the premiums that they collect to handle what we might call the catastrophic type occurrence, usually 2 or 3% of the gross premiums go into kind of like a trust fund that they save as a reserve or contingency. And we've got a information from Scott Goldsmith on the premium tax that the state collects on all the insurance policies that are collected or that are placed up here, somewhere to the tune of, say, $25 million. And part of it goes to operate the Department of Insurance, but
no,
the balance sort of goes into...
No, sir. Not a dime. Not a dime.
Well, I need clarification. I thought part of that pays for the Department of Insurance, but the rest goes to someplace else.
Not a dime. Our operations are paid for by fees that we charge for examinations, et cetera.
The whole works goes in the general fund.
The whole works goes in
the general fund. So there's sort of within the insurance industry itself a source of funds to help take care of this kind of problem. But also when it comes to, say, if we end up with a statewide type of health insurance program, maybe a 1 or 2% portion of the premium could be used to kind of fund this thing. And looking at the system that Doc has outlined here is, I think, an inherent intent of fairness here to try to do the best we can for everybody. And it would seem to me that maybe we could take care of the problem as Virginia has outlined, to get some of this to the damaged party without all the other kind of costs that absorb so much.
Okay. I hate to draw this to a close, but that's what we have to do. Dr. Thorne needs to leave at 12:30.
We've got another 15 minutes left.
Okay. Oh, we do. Oh, okay. I thought she had to leave at 12:30. I'm sorry. Okay, we can continue this discussion then for 15 more minutes, if there's more to say. Dr.
I'd like to just make some comments from the hospital perspective. Some hospitals now are doing some of this upfront work that Ron is talking about, but doing it at the institutional level. And whenever there is a case where there might be a possible claim, is to begin to gather facts and to begin to meet and talk with the people that were impacted, and hopefully try to settle it before a claim is filed and before you go through that extensive fact-finding and the payment process. The situation for hospitals is that there are a number of claims filed that you may have no idea that there was some dissatisfaction with. But there is a lot of work being done now in terms of cases where we are aware or are made aware that there's a concern. And what we're beginning to see is that we're having less claims filed against us.
Can I ask a question about that? Sister, I'm sorry, I don't know much about this. What kind of claims are hospitals liable for? And are you liable for the actions of the staff physicians? I assume not physicians who are just...
We are named in claims for physicians that are on contract with the hospital or physicians who work in the hospital, all of our staff people. We can be named in any suit. We can be found
if the facility
guilty or
is
not
used,
guilty in any.
If the facility is used at all, you're out there as a potential.
Right.
So theoretically,
we're often named in any claim, regardless of whether you could find fault or not.
So theoretically, private physicians as well as
the
hospital.
Oh, yes.
OB claims for
delivery. Oh, yes. We're named in almost all claims against any private physician who performs the service in the hospital.
Is it normal then that if a claim were to be lost in that instance, how does that finally shake out then? Is there an award paid, part of the award paid by the hospital, part of the award paid by the physician insurance company if they have insurance? Is that...
Yes.
And you buy malpractice from companies, or are you self-insured through the Providence Network?
We're self-insured.
As a single entity or the whole Providence?
Our whole Providence.
Right.
Providence.
I'd like to ask a question. In cases where you are sued and the case is found to be without merit, what percentage of the time do you get your attorney's fees back?
Virginia, I don't know that.
Never.
What's been the impact of the 88 joint several liability change? I mean, have you seen a positive impact from that? Or?
I haven't, Mike.
See, the way the old system worked under joint several liability, at least the theory was that everybody got sued and any one of them could pay 100%. Now, under several liability, you pay for the share that you're responsible for. That's how it's supposed to work in theory, although I understand there's some problems with it.
Some problems with it.
Sister Ghana, could you
especially
talk
if
to
someone
your,
is uninsured.
Sister Ghana, could you talk to your legal staff and see if they, you know, could give you some information to report back at the next meeting about the impact of that law change?
Joint several?
Sure.
I don't know that we can pull that out, but
okay.
We can.
Well, whatever.
And I'd like to know what percentage of the, you know, cases that have been filed against you were say that it was a case without merit, what percentage of cases you've gotten your attorney's fees back, your court costs back.
But the way you have to do that, though, because in a lot of cases, it's not strictly determined, or it's not determined whether or not it's meritorious or not. There's a settlement agreement,
right.
And
it's less expensive.
I mean, it's real.
Right.
It's never a very clear picture, because remember we had this problem.
If it goes to court, is the jury that decides the percentage of liability on each party?
I have to think how it works usually.
I think that decision is made before you go to court, because you go. The one you take to court is the one that is, quote, responsible. I'm trying to think in the cases I've seen since 1988.
In the cases that we're involved in with physicians, it's often our insurance company and their insurance company that make that determination, pretty much.
Are there other questions or requests for information that we'd like to pose? We go through this little exercise after every topic. so that we have the information people need at the next meeting for us to get anywhere on any of these things. Jay?
We have an idea by looking at this stuff what the magnitude of malpractice insurance cost is for physicians. I'd like to get an idea, if we could, of what it is for hospitals. I don't know if Harlan has that information for all the, or generally what it'd be for a small hospital, medium size, a large,
yeah.
Or something like that.
We can get that information for you. It's 2 years old.
Several
now,
years.
So why don't we update it?
Jerry?
I got a letter from Mike Lockwood, who's the administrator of our hospital, but he works for a Blue Star Home Society on some 600 of them around the country. And he claims 7%, which is a composite of insurance costs plus all the other kinds of things that need to go in there to minimize the liability factors. Depends on medicine, I think.
7% of their revenues?
Just as an overall hospital cost, which is a threat of malpractice.
I have a question
on
the OB issue. Are you aware, Rod, what insurance requirements say midwives have? I know we've had an increase in midwives in the state of Alaska. It seems that we have. Do you have any idea what their malpractice costs are?
No, I don't. I know Micah.
Or if they carry insurance? Or?
Yeah, that Micah insured a lot of them, but I don't know what the rates are.
And that number, it'd be interesting to see how much that number has increased as doctors have stopped delivering, if the midwives fill that gap.
That's a whole other area to save money on, is to have nurse midwives deliver babies. They do it better than docs. They really do. Now, the docs can come in and complications and complex things, but routine, it's cheaper and better to have nurse midwives. But they're more interested in it. The docs get kind of jaded as normal. That's an area to save money.
Thank
that the nurse midwife should be underpaid. I'm not
going to find that. They get Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement, do they? If they're nurse practitioners, they will send it Bill 211? It's in the House that will allow Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement for all nurse practitioners.
Well, it's not in my committee.
Could it be? It is coming.
As soon as it gets there, we'll look at it. Is that your bill, Virginia?
Betty Davis, interest in House.
Oh, okay.
Question on the issue of, still back on this issue of, we already have something in state law, although it's not working, on alternative resolution dispute. And what I would be interested in looking at is the provisions of that, and maybe a little analysis on, you know, from a budget, from maybe the lawyer's point of view also, why nobody's using it. And I'm assuming there are other models of alternative resolution dispute out there on this one, and I'm not suggesting that we go out and get a laundry list, but maybe have Larry look at this and see if there are, you know, elements of this that have been adopted in other states or.
Yeah. Yeah. Larry could get those. Those are false, or no fault systems, and the special OB and vaccine injury systems where it's fairly automatic.
Okay, Nancy, let's ask Larry to do that, and also let's ask the State Medical Association and the attorneys groups or whatever to comment on the existing arbitration, why nobody uses it, what would have to be changed in it for them to use it from their particular interests, and if they have any suggestions along that line. Anything else that would help us?
That's interesting.
Yeah, Rod, thank you for the work that you put into it, and we'll continue the discussion.
Okay, well, if you'll bear with us, we're going to kind of go back to yesterday for about 15 minutes, if that's okay. Dr. Thorne was here yesterday, and there was a misunderstanding as to the role that she was playing representing Senator Petula and what was she wanted to do yesterday, and I think it's appropriate that we spend about 15 minutes letting Dr. Thorne present what Senate Bill 74 does. We had a presentation yesterday from the Division of Insurance. We'd asked them to do a kind of a comparison between the model NAIC legislation 74, and we have not had a presentation on exactly how the sponsor view 74 was supposed to do. And so just kind of switch our thinking back to that. I would appreciate it. Why don't you come up to the table? And we're having some copies of 74 made. And the reason why this is important right now is because we will be coming back to all these areas again in the next meeting, and I think it's important for people to have clearly in mind what 74 does and how it fits into the total package. Our hope next meeting is to move ourselves pretty close to making some final decisions, because the meeting after that we're going to make some decisions. So I think it's important to have this before us.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
What is the meeting after? It's 29th and 30th. Is there another day?
29th and 1st is the next, 29th of February and 1st of March are the meetings here.
Yeah.
And then the 14th and 15th in Juneau. The 14th is kind of a work session day where we're going to really get things finalized. And then 15th will be a formal recommendation day where it will be a formal task force meeting where we can take.
But that is in?
That's in Juneau. We're going to take motions and make final recommendations. So it's my hope, and I think everybody else's hope, the next meeting will become pretty close to making some final decisions.
Like draft recommendations.
Draft recommendations. So we're almost there, but we've still got one more run through at it to figure out what we need to do. So Senate Bill 74 is being passed out. Dr. Thorne, why don't you go ahead, and I know you have a plane to catch, and you've read through it, and if you want to take some questions, we'll be happy to allow that also. Apologize yesterday for the misunderstanding.
Thank you. Senator Petula apologizes for not being able to speak here. He has a problem with his back. Not sit for long periods of time. He does all this work standing up. So he sent me to represent him on Senate Bill 74. And it's very sorry for him to be here, and hopes to be able to participate in meetings when you come to Juneau. Senate Bill 74 is a high risk pool for uninsurables. It creates a mechanism to make health insurance available to those who are unable to obtain insurance on the open market. The bill creates a comprehensive health insurance association on the model legislation that is still currently the NAIC model legislation. They are working on a newer draft that has not been finalized, but the changes in that we are looking at and
there, a few of them may be incorporated into this bill. Membership in the Comprehensive Health Insurance Association is mandatory for all health insurers in the state as a condition of their doing business in Alaska. This bill creates a board of directors chosen by the members of the association, i.e. all those who are insured and are carriers in the state. And those members select a board of directors, and that board of directors will contract with the insurance carrier to administer the state plan. Two kinds of plans must be offered from this pool. One is a major medical plan for those under 65 years of age, and another is a Medicare supplement policy for those who are over 65 years of age. To qualify for coverage, one must be able to show that they have been rejected by two health insurance carriers in the previous 6 months, or they have a policy but have had an exclusion rider placed on their policy for a specific medical condition. So, for example, if you have developed diabetes at age 45 and you have a policy in effect that your insurer has said that they will no longer cover diabetes, then you would qualify for this pool because in effect you don't have full coverage. The bill provides for a 20% co-payment of all charges up to a limit of $2,000 with a $1 million maximum coverage. Deductibles are set at $200, $500, and $1,000. So people will have a choice of what deductible that they would choose. Pre-existing conditions can be excluded for coverage for a period of 6 months if the condition became evident within the previous 3 months. This provides for, it allows people to enter the plan and then before they discover that they have a new condition. This is just the survival of the pool. It's important that they not wait till they have a condition and then join. However, a waiver of a pre-existing condition clause or a waiting period is possible if a person is involuntarily dropped from coverage by an insurance company. If that insurance company has a pre-existing waiting period and the person has met the pre-existing condition waiting period under that policy, they have 31 days to apply for coverage if they're dropped, and automatically that pre-existing condition is waived. There's a good transition period. This is one sticking point. I mentioned this yesterday. That in the previous meeting 2 weeks ago, they said that this bill did not have that clause, and it does. It just that the person who spoke to it hadn't had a chance to review the bill. The premiums will be charged to the individual and is capped at 125% of the standard premium paid for a similar policy in the state. So that if the standard policy costs $100 a month, this premium would cost, the premium for this coverage would be $125 per month. It would use separate scales of premiums based on age and geographic location in the state. The experience of the 26 other states that have this coverage and are providing coverage for half the populace of the United States at this point in time is that there are losses from these pools. Premiums do not cover the entire amount, as was mentioned yesterday. The losses, the average loss ratio is 1.65, which means that they bring in, the claims are 1.65 times the amount of premiums that they bring in. In the earlier years, the loss ratio is usually less than one, and mature plans have been going since 1976. The loss ratio can be up to 200%. Those are in industrial states that have very high-tech teaching hospital centers with a lot of transplants and a lot of leukemia and bone marrow transplants going on. So in the rural states that don't have these kinds of teaching centers, which Alaska would be like in the rural states, we would not expect a loss ratio of 200%. The loss is shared among all the insurers who are writing insurance in the state, in proportion to the amount of their share of the premiums written in the state. Now, this is, it's been pointed out that this loss will be probably passed on by the insurers to all the low-risk people insured in the state, or the regular risk people insured in the state. An experience in other states is that this loss, this assessment, is 1% of the total premiums written. And I was mentioning yesterday, we were trying to do some local, some calculations based on what we know. And it indeed came out to about 1%. When you spread the risk from 8,000 people, not all of those 8,000 people who are uninsurable at this point in time will be able to purchase the insurance because it is more expensive than the standard risk. The low estimate of the number of people who would be able to afford the insurance would be 1,000. The high estimate would be 2,700. If you spread the risk from those 2,700 over the 200,000 that are probably insured by the private sector, non-ERISA, private insurance pool in the state, you can see that the risk, the added cost in premiums to all of the others will not be high. 1% is a matter of dollars. Senate Bill 74 last year received a fiscal note from the Division of Insurance of $9,400 for the administrative costs of the director to approve the plan's approval and to oversee their activities. Excuse me. We believe that this is a very important piece of the jigsaw puzzle that is coming together from all the pieces of legislation in the state. It complements Senator Collins' bill, Senate Bill 242, because it will cover those who are self-employed, retired, or employees of small employers with less than 3 employees. It will exclude all those who have coverage. If you have Medicaid, if you have Medicare, Medicare, there will be a Medicare supplement policy available. But if you have other sources of coverage, then you will not get into this pool. It would also complement it would be not in competition with the children's bill. What I would understand, if they had coverage under a children's bill, then they would not qualify for this. We have another bill which I will speak to next week, Senate Bill 73, which if passed, would be able to subsidize some of those in a high-risk group with non-employed insurance. It's a subsidy bill that would provide for a sliding scale subsidy for those up to twice the Alaska poverty level.
For the same population, for the high-risk population?
Yes, yes. There would be a mechanism to provide subsidy to individuals. It's a separate bill because this bill is creating an independent association of insurers who cover all the risk. 73 is a something that would be funded out of the general fund. But if 73 and 74 passed, they would work, they would dovetail. So I'll speak to 73 next week. Sorry. Senator Cotillo would very much appreciate your favorable consideration and thoughts on this, and we'd very much like your input.
Jay, I had a question. You mentioned that there had to be a board of directors set up to essentially oversee the operation and assess the insurance. 242 has that same requirement. We talked about before about whether this could be the same board. I don't know if maybe there's a Dave question. I don't know if there's any conflict within the insurance, the way insurance is regulated, it would preclude boards for doing the same thing.
Well, I think that whole issue has to be finessed in terms of how.
Okay.
Has to do what? Finessed.
Another new word.
Basically, they're two separate pools.
Right.
And the rules in the model legislation and Senator Collins' bill covering 242 are different than the ones in 74. So that you could have two different pools under the somehow some same administrative structure.
Are they different? Two of the different companies?
Yes, they are different companies.
So there's no, so what, okay.
So the talking with the Division of Insurance, one person in the Division of Insurance, I had an understanding at the hearing last week that he was suggesting that both pools could be merged. And speaking to him later in the week, he said, I didn't say that. So.
Well, I think there's a difference between having separate pools and having an administrative structure. And I think that needs to be explored.
Except, yes, it should be looked at. The administrative, the members would be different because the membership in this pool would include, for 74, would include all those who write insurance for the private sector, non-ERISA insurers in the state. And Senator Collins' pool, 242, would cover all the insurers who wrote insurance for small insurers. So it's a subset of the larger group that would be covering the 74.
I think that's important. One of the things we want to be sure is we don't duplicate administrative functions here. And of course, so we need to work through that next week or next meeting and the meeting after that as to what, there's a board here, there's a board in Senator Collins' bill, and of course we're also talking about a different overall commission authority that, and we want to be sure that that all melds together. I really don't see the board and the composition of the board as the heart and soul of your legislation, quite honestly. I mean,
I think that's an excellent point because Senator Collins has other things in cost control, and there certainly would be a way of coordinating it and working with panels and so on within the overall structure. And we're not going to cut costs if we've got, you know,
right,
four different panels out there, everybody doing their thing, and again, having to find a way to link those. So I would hope there could be some discussion on how those do.
Children's health corporation is a monster.
Yeah.
But that's not the real, I mean, the
administrative structure
is not the heart.
Right.
It's not the most important part of your legislation. We can bring that all together. It's the other components, the same as Senator Collins' bill. The other components are really important components.
We just want people in Alaska who have the money and can afford it to get insurance, be able to get insurance now. Because otherwise, they are going to suffer the indignity of spending down to the point that they're on Medicaid and more dependent on the state. And if they're able to spend in an anticipatory fashion, participate like the rest, then it corrects one of the problems that this very competitive market is creating.
And then do you have a chart that shows, you know, for the 1,000 to 2,700 projected participants, what the amount of increase in the private pay premiums would, what it would increase, or what would be assessed, passed on to the consumers by the private carriers to pay for that?
I am working on, Senator Strzelewski asked us to do that, and to also look at the amount that this fund will actually save in terms of bad debt. And I've done some the problem is that we don't have numbers. We don't know how much people have to spend down to before they go on Medicaid. So it's almost impossible to make these calculations. But we're working on it. One of the problems is at this point in time, we don't have the exact numbers on the number of people insured in this thing. So it's very hard to know how many people who are covered by the private sector versus ERISA. ERISA would not participate in the assessments from this pool. People covered by ERISA, federal exemption, cannot be regulated by the state legislature.
Sure. So you could also, when we get to 73 in future discussions, you could, you know, we'll also want to know, and I know it's very hard to pull out, the amount of, you talked about people spending down and becoming Medicaid cases when their incomes are gone. The amount of state subsidy that would be proposed at different levels of participation by people with pre-existing conditions, and how many people in a given year routinely come on to Medicaid after spending down because of not being able to obtain private health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all of the 73, but you might want to start trying to work on those figures as well.
Mr. Chair, I just finished a pretty exhaustive study of the for persons with disabilities in Alaska and the status of their financing for the Choice Project. And one really wonderful thing about this bill is that it can be done in tandem with the Choice Project, because children with disabilities. There are many, many families in Alaska who have the money to buy insurance, to buy some kind of normal insurance. They can't afford the kind of insurance because their child is maxed out, their lifetime max is gone, you know, as a result of the birth or the neonatal stay, or the premium is so high that all they're getting is the major medical. And the Choice Project removes the most severely disabled children and adults from the pool and puts them on Medicaid. And so, and that's for the children, I think it's going to be around 100 children. Those are the most spending kids we have, 100,000, 150,000 per kid. There are lots of parents out there, I think, who could afford this kind of insurance, who have children who are not going to qualify for the Choice Project. And I think for persons with disabilities who are adults, who are not over 65, there's also a lot of people in that area that are, they're just not going to ever qualify for Medicaid because they don't meet the definition of SSI determination. They can be substantially gainfully employed in some way, although, or they're in a 2-year waiting period between Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, it's just a tremendous amount of traps you can get into out there. And they can't get into a pool. So the good thing about this is that it would take these individuals who are going to be higher cost out of the other pool. At the same time, Choice is coming on. That's a really important point, and I hope that that can get reduced in your cost. Because you're the most spending people are going to be out.
I would like to get with you more and try to understand Choice better and understand the cost.
Great.
Thank you.
You had a question about the cost, and we don't have this on a chart to give you because we're trying to get better numbers for that Blue Cross and trying to firm up some of the numbers, but just running rough estimates with gross assumptions, we figured that the loss to the pool would increase premiums 1% if you take into consideration the reduction of bad debt, that would bring increase to the premiums down to 7% because currently premiums reflect bad debt because the premium payers have to pick up the cost of bad debt and the charges for the loss of acquisitions. That would bring it down to about 0.7%. And then if you took into consideration the number of people that would have to go on the Medicaid and be paid for through state funds and so on, we bring it down to about 0.5%.
Is there any way to safeguard that this group doesn't pass on to other premium payers a larger percentage than is justified by the losses of the pool, the documentable losses of the pool?
Yeah.
The only way that that could be guaranteed is if the Division of Insurance did rate review of all health insurance carriers in the state.
I just asked if there was, could be, if there isn't a legislation, which I guess there isn't now, but if there could be any way to prevent the carriers from increasing the percentage increase passed on to the other consumers. If there's any way to restrict them from not passing on or raising the rate more than what is justified by the actual documentable losses of such a pool. And she mentioned rate setting, so I wanted to draw.
At this point, we do not have rate authority for health. And we get it essentially through the back door because we do have regulatory authority for forms. And most of the companies, particularly the big ones, are pretty good in working with us. But the best safeguard, in my view, would be for the division to have rate approval in health.
Okay, and what's the status of that? You brought that up at our very first task force meeting, and the governor never put in a bill. So are you going to bring before this task force a recommendation for us to recommend a legislation or amendments to existing legislation to give you that power?
We would like that very much. The reason we didn't put it in our bill this year is that our focus is to get nationally accredited this year.
Sure.
And the rate approval, I think, is going to be a real fight. And I decided, the decision was completely mine.
Okay, sure.
That I didn't want to wrap accreditation around the rate issue.
Sure, that's your focus. That's no reason why we can't pursue it and try and do good things with this task force. So
and God bless you for that effort.
Okay. So you're gonna, but we need your help in some language for a recommendation, you know, we're almost to that point now. Draft okay. recommendations next meeting. Final recommendations March 15th. And that would help us.
Pardon? Can I ask a question about that? What does that mean?
Yeah, what's that
what?
Mean?
Rate approval.
That means that, that before a company, and we have rate approval in most other lines, before a company can charge a rate, they have to file it with us.
A premium rate?
Right.
Just
right.
file it. No approval. No
well,
file.
The way, there are a number of different ways that it's done in various states, but we have here in our lines of insurance our what's called a deemer provision, and that is they file it 30 days after it's filed. If we haven't disapproved it, it's automatically approved.
We do it for other kinds of insurance.
All other kinds of insurance.
Excuse me, just not health.
Yeah, just not health. There are other ways of doing it. There's file and use and file, etc. But the most conservative, file and use means that the moment you file it, you can use it. And then we have to go in and say, no, you can't, and go through all sorts of stuff to kind of roll it back. The other is use and file, which means they can put it in, and then at some point within 30 or 60 or in one state's case 120 days, at that point let the regulatory authority know. We are prior approval, and I like it that way, and because I think that it's ultimately better for the consumer.
The reality is that the tax that is paid on the premium, which is predicated on the rate, is revenue, right?
Right.
So in a time of declining revenues, are you going to be in a bind where you're not going to, you know, you're in the situation you're going to be in is mm-hmm. if right now you're collecting $25 million and it's coming into the general fund, and we do such a wonderful job with the task force here and the legislation and all the premiums go down, then it's going to cost us money on the other end. We ought to kind of look at that, huh?
Well, that's to date has not been a consideration for us because the average premium tax, well, the premium taxes vary by line from 0% on some types of title up to a high, I think, of 3.7 on some of the non-admitted. But if you assume an average tax rate of 2%, that's not a lot of money. And the revenue side of rate approval has never figured in. I mean, for us, for the level of tax we have to affect the state's revenue picture, you know, to make up for Prudhoe Bay, for example, we'd have to have some pretty damn high insurance rates of 2%.
I said it may not be in our best interest to be reducing the premium rates. One of the things that I would hope that we get out of this is that we get some kind of a tracking mechanism or reporting mechanism so that we're able to, after a year or two, go back and really see if there has been, you know, if whatever we do, you know, what the result has been and who it's impacted and, you know, what are the minuses and the pluses. And I think that'd be real important to do that.
Yeah, that is a big part of at least one or two pieces of the legislation for that kind of required information and tracking. And so that's, I agree, that's a big part of it.
That's what we need to do.
Jake?
Just one more quick comment. I did some work when I used to work at House Research, I did some work on these kinds of pools in other states. One of the things that I recall from that was that for that kind of marketing or outreach or advertising or anything like that. I thought this person was only $7,000. That just doesn't seem like much money to do.
The marketing, there is provision for marketing.
Okay, good.
And that would be part of the cost of the administration of the insurance program, which is internal to the system, would not be passed on. Fiscal note is what the cost would be to the last.
Okay, who's going to do the marketing then? The
marketing would be done by either the association or the carrier.
I see, okay.
And that would be part of their contract. Yeah, it would be part of what is coming in their contract.
Okay, thank you.
But it is very important.
Sure, good question.
Portability, if they move to Florida, is their coverage void?
Yes. Yeah. It's state.
So it could be Florida's problem.
That's a very interesting issue. What if somebody's been covered in a high-risk pool in Illinois? This is definitely based on residency. You have to live here 6 months. So,
okay, thank you very much. Any other questions, Dr. Thorne?
I have a question. What would you like in writing that would help you understand or process the bill?
Pardon?
What would you like in writing
it would help you understand or process the bill more easily. I would get it to you.
Oh, if you could do a flow chart for us, that would probably be helpful if you want to do that. Just kind of a flow chart as to how the legislation works. I think we probably have a pretty good understanding, but if you feel we need a better one, any information you want to provide would be...
Flow chart.
Sure.
And
we'll be coming back to the legislation next week and the week after, so...
Is there a sectional analysis in plain English?
Yeah. We're going to revisit it again, and you'll be around, so...
I guess what would help me is the premium cost again, and as you get closer on the numbers, the premium cost to the consumer, projected premium, I know you have one. Is this your final numbers here?
No, that was a rough estimate taken from Montana, which has a similar population base. Yeah, that's 35%.
But some of that, I think, is information that the division will generate as they do it. Whoever wants to do it, but I think we'll also be asking the division.
We're working on it already.
Right, to do that kind of information.
Yeah,
so.
How this bill relates to Senator Collins' bill in the sense that are we now creating a seamless network for uninsurable individuals so that if they're covered in a pool through their job and they quit their job, I'm not quite sure when the insurance from the Senator Collins' bill may provide becomes the insurance that can be provided out of the pool.
If they quit the job and they lose coverage in the Senator Collins bill, they would have to apply to the high risk pool. If they had a high risk condition, they didn't qualify for the insurance. They would have to apply for the high risk pool within 31 days and would be covered. Now, the only thing is that this bill says that they have to be rejected by two insurers.
And do they have to wait 6 months? They would have to wait 6 months, just 30 days.
Just 30 days.
I think by next meeting, at least in my mind, we're going to ask to have that kind of laid out as to what the various components are and what does what.
So that should be able to flow from one to the other.
So yes, we're going to try, so we can kind of tie this together a little, as a package a little bit, so we can see exactly what 242 does and what 74 does and what the other bills do and how they interact and relate. So I think that's a good question, Jay, and I'm not sure, but I think we can do that on a chart for next time.
Yeah.
Which will help us understand how all these fit together and how all, you know, what portion of the market they all impact. I think that's important to know. And we'll try to do that. But we'll be asking someone to do that as an overall, not to do it individually, so it ties together.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I guess we're about ready to wrap it up today then. And let me just kind of... go through where I think we're going to be for next time and what we hope to do. We'll come back to all these areas and we'll get it out to you as soon as possible, but come back to the various areas that we've touched on again. And the idea will be to try to move forward to some preliminary draft decisions, right? Nothing final, but at least crystallize our thinking to a great extent next time as to what's doable and what we're impacting. So that people can have that at the end of the next meeting to go away and think about before our final decision-making meeting in June on March 14th and 15th. So we're going to try to draw everything together as best we can and make some preliminary decisions to see how they all relate. I might also add, and Rick and Elsa, I just discussed this, we'll do the same hours on Saturday next time, 9 to whatever. It may be quite possible we're going to do a longer Sunday meeting next time because we're getting down to the end. So we're going to have to start making some preliminary decisions at least. And some of these areas are still a little bit muddy. Others are clearer than some. And we still, you know, we'll come back to malpractice. We'll come back to all these areas next time. So we'll get an agenda together. We're trying to get it out late this week, this coming week, or early next week, so you'll have it. Is there any other? And Larry will be be here, which, and that's why I think it's important that we get to the point next time of being able to make some preliminary decisions with Larry here to help us, help guide us under that. Any other questions or comments that you might have? Okay. All right. Okay. Then we'll see you 29th and the 1st, and hopefully we can move forward to decisions.